going to meet the challenge head on. I was determined to win, and thus everything other than a strike made me irritable. Above all, she was learning that marrying a man with a startup shoe company meant living on a shoestring budget. And yet she thrived. I could give her only $25 a week for groceries, and still she managed to whip up delicious meals. I gave her a credit card with a $2,000 limit to furnish our entire apartment, and she managed to buy a dinette table, two chairs, a Zenith TV, and a big couch with soft arms, perfect for napping. She also bought me a brown recliner, which she stuck in a corner of the living room. Now each night I could lean back at a 45-degree angle and spin inside my own head all I wanted. It was more comfortable and safer than the Cougar. I got into the habit every night of phoning my father from my recliner. He'd always be in his recliner too, and together, recliner to recliner, we'd hash out the latest threat confronting Blue Ribbon. He no longer saw my business as a waste of my time, apparently. Though he didn't say so explicitly, he did seem to find the problems I faced interesting and challenging, which amounted to the same thing. In the spring of 1969, Penny began to complain of feeling poorly in the mornings. Food didn't sit well. By midday, she was often a little wobbly around the office. She went to the doctor, the same doctor who delivered her, and discovered she was pregnant. We were both overjoyed, but we also faced a whole new learning curve. Our cozy apartment was now completely inappropriate. We'd have to buy a house, of course. But could we afford a house? I just started to pay myself a salary. And in which part of town should we buy? Where were the best schools? And how was I supposed to research real estate prices in schools, plus all the other things that go into buying a house, while running a startup company? Was it even feasible to run a startup company while starting a family? Should I go back to accounting or teaching or something more stable? Leaning back in my recliner each night, staring at the ceiling, I tried to settle myself. I told myself, life is growth. You grow or you die. We found a house in Beaverton. Small, only 1,600 square feet, but it had an acre of land around it, and a little horse corral, and a pool. There was also a huge pine tree in the front, and a Japanese bamboo out back. I loved it. More, I recognized it. When I was growing up, my sisters asked me several times what my dream house would look like. And one day they handed me a charcoal pencil and a pad and made me draw it. After Penny and I moved in, my sisters dug out the old charcoal sketch. It was an exact picture of the Beaverton house. The price was $34,000, and I popped my shirt buttons to discover that I had 20% of that in savings. On the other hand, I'd pledged those savings against my many loans at First National. So I went down to talk to Harry White. I need the savings for a down payment on a house, I said, but I'll pledge the house. Okay, he said. On this one, we don't have to consult Wallace. That night I told Penny that if Blue Ribbon failed, we'd lose the house. She put a hand on her stomach and sat down. This was the kind of insecurity she'd always vowed to avoid. Okay, she kept saying, okay. With so much at stake, she felt compelled to keep working for Blue Ribbon, right through her pregnancy. She would sacrifice everything to Blue Ribbon, even her goal of graduating from college. And when she wasn't physically in the office, she would run a mail-order business out of the new house. In 1969 alone, despite morning sickness, swollen ankles, weight gain, and constant fatigue, Penny got out 1,500 orders. Some of the orders were nothing more than crude tracings of a human foot, sent in by customers in far-flung places, but Penny didn't care. She dutifully matched the tracing to the correct shoe and filled the order. Every sale counted. At the same time that my family outgrew its home, so did my business. One room beside the pink bucket could no longer contain us. Also, Woodell and I were tired of shouting to be heard above that jukebox. So each night after work, we'd go out for cheeseburgers, then drive around looking at office space. Logistically, it was a nightmare. Waddell had to drive because his wheelchair wouldn't fit in my Cougar, and I always felt guilty and uncomfortable being chauffeured by a man with so many limitations. I also felt crazed with nerves, because many of the offices we looked at were up a flight of stairs, or several flights. This meant I'd have to wheel Waddell up and down. At such moments, I was reminded, painfully, of his reality. During a typical workday, Waddell was so positive, so energetic, it was easy to forget. But wheeling him, maneuvering him, upstairs, downstairs, I was repeatedly struck by how delicate, how helpless he could be. I'd pray under my breath, "Please don't let me drop him. Please don't let me drop him." Waddell, hearing me, would tense up, and his tension would make me more nervous. "Relax," I'd say, feigning calm. "I haven't lost a patient yet." No matter what happened, he'd never lose his composure. Even at his most vulnerable, with me balancing him precariously at the top of some dark flight of stairs, he'd never lose touch with his essential philosophy, "Don't you dare feel sorry for me. I'm here to kill you." The first time I ever sent him to a trade show, the airline lost his wheelchair. And when they found it, the frame was bent like a pretzel. No problem. In his mutilated chair, Waddell attended the show, ticked off every item on his to-do list, and came home with an ear-to-ear, mission-accomplished smile on his face. At the end of each night's search for new office space, Waddell and I would always have a big belly laugh about the whole debacle. Most nights we'd wind up at some dive bar, giddy, almost delirious. Before parting, we'd often play a game. I'd bring out a stopwatch, and we'd see how fast Waddell could fold up his wheelchair and get it and himself into his car. As a former track star, he loved the challenge of a stopwatch, of trying to beat his personal best. His record was 44 seconds. We both cherished those nights, the silliness, the sense of shared mission, and we mutually ranked them among the solid gold memories of our young lives. Waddell and I were very different, and yet our friendship was based on several key things we had in common. Each of us found pleasure, whenever possible, in focusing on one small task. One task, we often said, clears the mind. And each of us recognized that this small task of finding a bigger office meant we were succeeding. We were making a go of this thing called Blue Ribbon, which spoke to a deep desire in each of us to succeed, to win, or at least not lose. Though neither of us was much of a talker, we brought out a chatty streak in each other. Those nights we discussed everything, opened up to each other with unusual candor. Waddell told me in detail about his injury. If I was ever tempted to take myself too seriously, Waddell's story always reminded me that things could be worse. And the way he handled himself was a constant bracing lesson in the virtue and value of good spirits. His injury wasn't typical, he said, and it wasn't total. He still had some feeling, still had hopes of marrying, having a family. He also had hopes of a cure. He was taking an experimental new drug, which had shown promise in paraplegics. Trouble was, it had a garlicky aroma. Some nights on our office hunting expeditions, Waddell would smell like an old-school pizzeria, and I'd let him hear about it. I asked Waddell if he was, I hesitated, fearing I had no right, happy. He gave it some thought. "Yes," he said, "he was. He loved his work. He loved Blue Ribbon, though he sometimes cringed at the irony. A man who can't walk, peddling shoes." Not sure what to say to this, I said nothing. Often Penny and I would have Waddell over to the new house for dinner. He was like family. We loved him. But we also knew we were filling a void in his life, a need for company and domestic comforts. So Penny always wanted to cook something special when Waddell came over, and the most special thing she could think of was Cornish game hen, plus a dessert made from brandy and iced milk. She got the recipe from a magazine, which left us all blotto. Though hens and brandy put a serious dent in her $25 grocery budget, Penny simply couldn't economize when it came to Waddell. If I told her that Waddell was coming to dinner, she'd reflexively gush, "I'll get some capons and brandy." It was more than wanting to be hospitable. She was fattening him up. She was nurturing him. Waddell, I think, played on her newly activated maternal streak. I struggle to remember. I close my eyes and think back, but so many precious moments from those nights are gone forever. Numberless conversations, breathless laughing fits, declarations, revelations, confidences. They've all fallen into the sofa cushions of time. I remember only that we always sat up half the night cataloging the past, mapping out the future. I remember that we took turns describing what our little company was and what it might be and what it must never be. How I wish on just one of those nights I'd had a tape recorder or kept a journal as I did on my trip around the world. Still, at least I can always call to mind the image of Waddell seated at the head of our dinette, carefully dressed in his blue jeans, his trademark V-neck sweater over a white tee, and always on his feet a pair of Tigers, the rubber soles spotless, pristine. By then he'd grown a long beard and a bushy mustache, both of which I envied. Heck, it was the 60s. I'd have had a beard down to my chin. But I was constantly needing to go to the bank and ask for money. I couldn't look like a bum when I presented myself to Wallace. A clean shave was one of my few concessions to the man. Waddell and I eventually found a promising office in Tigard, south of downtown Portland. It wasn't a whole office building, we couldn't afford that, but a corner of one floor. The rest was occupied by the Horace Mann Insurance Company. Inviting, almost plush, it was a dramatic step up, and yet I hesitated. There had been a curious logic in our being next door to a honky-tonk, but an insurance company? With carpeted halls and water coolers and men in tailored suits? The atmosphere was so buttoned down, so corporate. Our surroundings, I felt, had much to do with our spirit, and our spirit was a big part of our success. And I worried how our spirit might change if we were suddenly sharing space with a bunch of organization men and automatons. I took to my recliner, gave it some thought, and decided a corporate vibe might be asymmetrical, contrary to our core beliefs, but it might also be just the thing with our bank. Maybe when Wallace saw our boring, sterile new office space, he'd treat us with respect. Also, the office was in Tigard. Selling Tigers out of Tigard. Maybe it was meant to be. Then I thought about Waddell. He said he was happy at Blue Ribbon, but he'd mentioned the irony. Maybe it was more than ironic, sending him out to high schools and colleges to sell Tigers out of his car. Maybe it was torture. And maybe it was a poor use of his talents. What suited Waddell best was bringing order to chaos, problem-solving. One small task. After he and I went together to sign the Tigard lease, I asked him if he'd like to change jobs, become operations manager for Blue Ribbon. No more sales calls, no more schools. Instead, he'd be in charge of dealing with all the things for which I didn't have the time and patience. Like talking to Bork in L.A., or corresponding with Johnson in Wellesley, or opening a new office in Miami, or hiring someone to coordinate all the new sales reps and organize their reports, or approving expense accounts. Best of all, Waddell would have to oversee the person who monitored company bank accounts. Now, if he didn't cash his own paychecks, he'd have to explain the overage to his boss, himself. Beaming, Waddell said he liked the sound of that very much. He reached out his hand. "Deal," he said. He still had the grip of an athlete. Penny went to the doctor in September 1969 for a checkup. The doctor said everything looked fine, but the baby was taking its time. Probably another week, he said. The rest of that afternoon, Penny spent at the Blue Ribbon, helping customers. We went home together, ate an early dinner, turned in early. About 4 a.m., she jostled me. "I don't feel so good," she said. I phoned the doctor and told him to meet us at Emmanuel Hospital. In the weeks before Labor Day, I'd made several practice trips to the hospital, and it was a good thing, because now, game time, I was such a wreck that Portland looked to me like Bangkok, Everything was strange, unfamiliar. I drove slowly to make sure of each turn. Not too slowly, I scolded myself, or you'll have to deliver the baby yourself. The streets were all empty. The lights were all green. A soft rain was falling. The only sounds in the car were Penny's heavy breaths and the wipers squeaking across the windshield. As I pulled up to the entrance of the emergency room, as I helped Penny into the hospital, she kept saying, "We're probably overreacting. I don't think it's time yet." Still, she was breathing the way I used to breathe in the final lap. I remember the nurse taking Penny from me, helping her into a wheelchair, rolling her down a hall. I followed along, trying to help. I had a pregnancy kit I packed myself with a stopwatch, the same one I'd used to time Woodell. I now timed Penny's contractions aloud. 5, 4, 3. She stopped panting and turned to me. Through clenched teeth, she said, "Stop doing that." A nurse now helped her out of the wheelchair and onto a gurney and rolled her away. I stumbled back down the hall into something the hospital called the bullpen, where expectant fathers were expected to sit and stare into space. I would have been in the delivery room with Penny, but my father had warned me against it. He told me that I'd been born bright blue, which scared the daylights out of him, and he therefore cautioned me, "At the decisive moment, be somewhere else." I sat in a hard plastic chair, eyes closed, doing shoe work in my mind. After an hour, I opened my eyes and saw our doctor standing before me. Beads of sweat glistened on his forehead. He was saying something. That is, his lips were moving, but I couldn't hear. "Life's a joy. Here's a toy. Are you Roy?" He said it again. "It's a boy." A boy. Really? "Your wife did a superb job," he was saying. "She did not complain once, and she pushed at all the right times. Has she taken many Lamaze classes?" "Lamaze," I said. "Pardon? What?" He led me like an invalid down a long hall and into a small room. There, behind a curtain, was my wife, exhausted, radiant, her face bright red. Her arms were wrapped around a quilted white blanket decorated with blue baby carriages. I pushed back a corner of the blanket to reveal a head the size of a ripe grapefruit, a white stocking cap perched on top. My boy. He looked like a traveler, which, of course, he was. He'd just begun his own trip around the world. I leaned down, kissed Penny's cheek. I pushed away her damp hair. "You're a champion," I whispered. She squinted, uncertain. She thought I was talking to the baby. She handed me my son. I cradled him in my arms. He was so alive, but so delicate, so helpless. The feeling was wondrous, different from all other feelings, though familiar, too. "Please don't let me drop him." At Blue Ribbon, I spent so much time talking about quality control, about craftsmanship, about delivery. But this, I realized, this was the real thing. "We made this," I said to Penny. "We made this." She nodded, then lay back. I handed the baby to the nurse and told Penny to sleep. I floated out of the hospital and down to the car. I felt a sudden and overpowering need to see my father, a kind of hunger for my father. I drove to his newspaper, parked several blocks away. I wanted to walk. The rain had stopped. The air was cool and damp. I ducked into a cigar store. I pictured myself handing my father a big, fat Robusto and saying, "Hiya, Grandpa." Coming out of the store, the wooden cigar box under my arm, I bumped straight into Keith Foreman, a former runner at Oregon. "Keith!" I cried. "Hey, you buck," he said. I grabbed him by the lapels and shouted, "It's a boy!" He leaned away, confused. He thought I was drunk. There wasn't time to explain. I kept walking. Foreman had been on the famous Oregon team that set the world record in the 4-mile relay. As a runner, as an accountant, I always remembered their stunning time, 16:08.9. A star on Bowerman's 1962 national championship team, Foreman had also been the fifth American ever to break the 4-minute mile. And to think, I told myself, only hours ago I'd thought those things made a champion. Fall. The woolen skies of November settled in low. I wore heavy sweaters and sat by the fireplace and did a sort of self-inventory. I was all stocked up on gratitude. Penny and my new son, whom we'd named Matthew, were healthy. Bork and Woodell and Johnson were happy. Sales continued to rise. Then came the mail. A letter from Bork. After returning from Mexico City, he was suffering some sort of mental Montezuma's revenge. He had problems with me, he told me in the letter. He didn't like my management style. He didn't like my vision for the company. He didn't like what I was paying him. He didn't understand why I took weeks to answer his letters, and sometimes didn't answer at all. He had ideas about shoe design, and he didn't like how they were being ignored. After several pages of all this, he demanded immediate changes, plus a raise. My second mutiny. This one, however, was more complicated than Johnson's. I spent several days drafting my reply. I agreed to raise his salary, slightly, and then I pulled rank. I reminded Bork that in any company there could only be one boss, and sadly for him, the boss of Blue Ribbon was Buck Knight. I told him if he wasn't happy with me or my management style, he should know that quitting and being fired were both viable options. As with my spy memo, I suffered instant writer's remorse. The moment I dropped it in the mail, I realized that Bork was a valuable part of the team, that I didn't want to lose him, that I couldn't afford to lose him. I dispatched our new operations manager, Woodell, to Los Angeles to patch things up. Woodell took Bork to lunch and tried to explain that I wasn't sleeping much, with a new baby and all. Also, Woodell told him, I was feeling tremendous stress after the visit from Kitami and Mr. Onitsuka. Woodell joked about my unique management style, telling Bork that everyone bitched about it, everyone pulled their hair out about my non-responses to their memos and letters. In all, Woodell spent a few days with Bork, smoothing his feathers, going over the operation. He discovered that Bork was stressed too. Though the retail store was thriving, the back room, which had basically become our national warehouse, was in shambles. Boxes everywhere, invoices and papers stacked to the ceiling. Bork couldn't keep pace. When Woodell returned, he gave me the picture. I think Bork's back in the fold, he said, but we need to relieve him of that warehouse. We need to transfer all warehouse operations up here. Moreover, he added, we needed to hire Woodell's mother to run it. She'd worked for years in the warehouse at Janssen, the legendary Oregon outfitter. So it wasn't nepotism, he said. Ma Woodell was perfect for the job. I wasn't sure I cared. If Woodell was good with it, I was good with it. Plus, the way I saw it, the more Woodells, the better. 1970. I had to fly to Japan again. And this time, 2 weeks before Christmas. I didn't like leaving Penny alone with Matthew, especially around the holidays, but it couldn't be avoided. I needed to sign a new deal with Onitsuka, or not. Kitami was keeping me in suspense. He wouldn't tell me his thoughts about renewing me until I arrived. Yet again I found myself at a conference table surrounded by Onitsuka executives. This time, Mr. Onitsuka didn't make his trademark late entrance, nor did he absent himself pointedly. He was there from the start, presiding. He opened the meeting by saying that he intended to renew Blue Ribbon for another 3 years. I exhaled, laughed, smiled for the first time in weeks. Then I pressed my advantage. I asked for a longer deal. Yes, 1973 seemed light years away, but it would be here in a blink. I needed more time and security. My bankers also needed more. 5 years, I said. Mr. Onitsuka shook his head. 3. He then gave a strange speech. Notwithstanding several years of sluggish worldwide sales, he said, plus some strategic missteps, the outlook was rosy for Onitsuka. Through cost-cutting and reorganization, his company had regained its edge. Sales for the upcoming fiscal year were expected to top $22 million, a good portion of which would come from the United States. A recent survey showed that 70% of all American runners owned a pair of Tigers. I knew that. Maybe I'd had a little something to do with that, I wanted to say. That's why I wanted a longer contract. But Mr. Onitsuka said that one major reason for Onitsuka's solid numbers was Kitami. He looked down the table, bestowed a fatherly smile on Kitami. Therefore, Mr. Onitsuka said, Kitami was being promoted. Henceforth, he'd be the company's operations manager. He'd now be Onitsuka's Woodell, though I remember thinking that I wouldn't trade one Woodell for 1,000 Kitamis. With a bow of my head, I congratulated Mr. Onitsuka on his company's good fortune. I turned and bowed my head at Kitami, congratulating him on his promotion. But when I raised my head and made eye contact with Kitami, I saw in his gaze something cold, something that stayed with me for days. We drew up the agreement. It was 4 or 5 paragraphs, a flimsy thing. The thought crossed my mind that it should be more substantive, and that it would be nice to have a lawyer vet it. But there wasn't time. We all signed it, then moved on to other topics. I was relieved to have a new contract, but I returned to Oregon feeling troubled, anxious, more so than at any time in the last 8 years. Sure, my briefcase held a guarantee that Onitsuka would supply me with shoes for the next 3 years, but why were they refusing to extend beyond 3? More to the point, the extension was misleading. Onitsuka was guaranteeing me a supply, but their supply was chronically, dangerously late, about which they still had a maddeningly blasé attitude. Little more days. With Wallace continually acting more like a loan shark than a banker, a little more days could mean disaster. And when the shipments from Onitsuka did finally arrive, they often contained the wrong number of shoes, often the wrong sizes, sometimes the wrong models. This kind of disarray clogged our warehouse and rankled our sales reps. Before I left Japan, Mr. Onitsuka and Kitami assured me that they were building new state-of-the-art factories. Delivery problems would soon be a thing of the past, they said. I was skeptical, but there was nothing I could do. I was at their mercy. Johnson, meanwhile, was losing his mind. His letters, once mumbly with angst, were becoming shrill with hysteria. The main problem was Bowerman's Cortez, he said. It was simply too popular. We'd gotten people hooked on the thing, turned them into full-blown Cortez addicts, and now we couldn't meet the demand, which created anger and resentment up and down the supply chain. God, we are really screwing our customers, Johnson wrote. Happiness is a boatload of Cortez. Reality is a boatload of Bostons with steel wool uppers, tongues made out of old razor blades, sizes 6 to 6.5. He was exaggerating, but not much. It happened all the time. I'd secure a loan from Wallace, then hang fire waiting for Onitsuka to send the shoes, and when the boat finally docked, it wouldn't contain any Cortezes. 6 weeks later, we'd get too many Cortezes, and by then it was too late. Why? It couldn't just be Onitsuka's decrepit factories, we all agreed. And sure enough, Woodell eventually figured out that Onitsuka was satisfying its local customers in Japan first, then worrying about foreign exports. Terribly unfair, but again, what could we do? We had no leverage. Even if Onitsuka's new factories ended all delivery problems, even if every shipment of shoes hit the water right on time with all the correct quantities of size 10s and no size 5s, I'd still face problems with Wallace. Bigger orders would require bigger loans, and bigger loans would be harder to pay off. And in 1970, Wallace was telling me that he wasn't interested in playing that game anymore. I recall one day sitting in Wallace's office. Both he and White were working me over pretty good. Wallace seemed to be enjoying himself, though White kept giving me looks that said, "Sorry, pal, this is my job." As always, I politely took the abuse they dished out, playing the role of meek small business owner. Long on contrition, short on credit. I knew the role backward and forward, but I remember feeling that at any moment I might cut loose a blood-curdling scream. Here I'd built this dynamic company from nothing, and by all measures it was thriving, sales doubling every year like clockwork. And this was the thanks I got? Two bankers treating me like a deadbeat? White, trying to cool things off, said a few nominal things in support of Blue Ribbon. I watched his words have no effect whatsoever on Wallace. I took a breath, started to speak, then stopped. I didn't trust my voice. I just sat up straighter and hugged myself. This was my new nervous tic, my new habit. Rubber bands were no longer cutting it, so whenever I felt stressed, whenever I wanted to choke someone, I'd wrap my arms good and tight around my torso. That day the habit was more pronounced. I must have looked as if I was practicing some exotic yoga pose I'd learned in Thailand. At issue was more than the old philosophical disagreement about growth. Blue Ribbon was approaching $600,000 in sales, and that day I'd gone in to ask for a loan of $1.2 million, a number that had symbolic meaning for Wallace. It was the first time I'd breached the million-dollar barrier. In his mind, this was like the four-minute mile. Very few people were meant to break it. He was weary of this whole thing, he said, weary of me. For the umpteenth time, he explained that he lived on cash balances, and for the umpteenth time, I suggested that if my sales and earnings were going up, 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 Wallace should be happy to have my business. Wallace rapped his pen on the table. My credit was maxed out, he said. Officially, irrevocably, immediately. He wasn't authorizing one more cent until I put some cash in my account and left it there. Meanwhile, henceforth, he'd be imposing strict sales quotas for me to meet. Miss one quota, he said, by even one day, and, well, he didn't finish the sentence. His voice trailed off, and I was left to fill the silence with worst-case scenarios. I turned to White, who gave me a look. What can I do, pal? Days later, Waddell showed me a telex from Onitsuka. The big spring shipment was ready to hit the water, and they wanted $20,000. Great, we said. For once, they're shipping the shoes on time. Just one hitch. We didn't have $20,000. And it was clear I couldn't go to Wallace. I couldn't ask Wallace for change of a five. So I telexed Onitsuka and asked them to hold the shoes, please, until we brought in some more revenue from our sales force. Please don't think we are in financial difficulty, I wrote. It wasn't a lie, per se. As I told Bowerman, we weren't broke, we just had no money. Lots of assets, no cash. We simply needed more time. Now it was my turn to say, little more days. While awaiting Onitsuka's response, I realized that there was only one way to solve this cash flow problem once and for all. A small public offering. If we could sell 30% of Blue Ribbon at $2 a share, we could raise $300,000 overnight. The timing for such an offering seemed ideal. In 1970, the first ever venture capital firms were starting to sprout up. The whole concept of venture capital was being invented before our eyes. Though the idea of what constituted a sound investment for venture capitalists wasn't very broad. Most of the new venture capital firms were in Northern California, so they were mainly attracted to high-tech and electronics companies. Silicon Valley, almost exclusively. Since most of those companies had futuristic-sounding names, I formed a holding company for Blue Ribbon and gave it a name designed to attract tech-happy investors. Sports Tech, Inc. Waddell and I sent out flyers advertising the offering, then sat back and braced for the clamorous response. Silence. A month passed. Deafening silence. No one phoned. Not one person. That is, almost no one. We did manage to sell 300 shares at $1 per to Waddell and his mother. Ultimately, we withdrew the offering. It was a humiliation, and in its wake, I had many heated conversations with myself. I blamed the shaky economy. I blamed Vietnam. But first and foremost, I blamed myself. I'd overvalued Blue Ribbon. I'd overvalued my life's work. More than once over my first cup of coffee in the morning, or while trying to fall asleep at night, I'd tell myself, maybe I'm a fool. Maybe this whole damn shoe thing is a fool's errand. Maybe, I thought. Maybe. I scraped together the $20,000 from our receivables, paid off the bank, and took delivery of the order from Onitsuka. Another sigh of relief, followed by a tightening in the chest. What would I do the next time? And the next? I needed cash. That summer was unusually warm. Languorous days of golden sunshine, clear blue skies, the world a paradise. It all seemed to mock me in my mood. If 1967 had been the summer of love, 1970 was the summer of liquidity, and I had none. I spent most of every day thinking about liquidity, talking about liquidity, looking to the heavens and pleading for liquidity. My kingdom for liquidity. An even more loathsome word than equity. Eventually, I did what I didn't want to do, what I'd vowed never to do. I put the touch on anybody with ears, friends, family, casual acquaintances. I even went with my hand out to former teammates, guys I'd sweated and trained and raced alongside, including my former arch-rival, Grella. I'd heard that Grella had inherited a pile from his grandmother. On top of that, he was involved in all sorts of lucrative business ventures. He worked as a salesman for two grocery store chains while selling caps and gowns to graduates on the side, and both ventures were said to be humming along. He also owned a great big chunk of land at Lake Arrowhead, someone said, and lived there in a rambling house. The man was born to win. He was even still running competitively, 1 year away from becoming the best in the world. There was an all-comers road race in Portland that summer, and Penny and I invited a group of people to the house afterward for a cocktail party. I made sure to invite Grella, then waited for just the right moment. When everyone was rested, a couple of beers to the good, I asked Grella for a word in private. I took him into my den and made my pitch short and sweet. New company, cash flow problems, considerable upside, yada yada. He was gracious, courteous, and smiled pleasantly. I'm just not interested, Buck. With nowhere else to turn, with no other options, I was sitting at my desk one day, staring out the window. Waddell knocked. He rolled into the office, closed the door. He said he and his parents wanted to loan me $5,000, and they wouldn't take no for an answer. They also wouldn't tolerate any mention of interest. In fact, they wouldn't even formalize the loan with any sort of papers. He was going to Los Angeles to see Bork, but while he was gone, he said, I should drive to his house and collect the check from his folks. Days later, I did something beyond imagining, something I didn't think myself capable of doing. I drove to Waddell's house and asked for the check. I knew the Waddells weren't people of means. I knew that. With their son's medical bills, they were scuffling more than I. This $5,000 was their life savings. I knew that. But I was wrong. His parents had a little bit more, and they asked if I needed that too, and I said yes, and they gave me their last $3,000, draining their savings down to zero. How I wished I could put that check in my desk drawer and not cash it. But I couldn't. I wouldn't. On my way out the door, I stopped. I asked them, why are you doing this? Because, his mother said, if you can't trust the company your son is working for, then who can you trust? Penny was continuing to find creative ways of stretching her $25 grocery allowance, which meant 50 kinds of beef stroganoff, which meant my weight ballooned. By the middle of 1970, I was around 190, an all-time high. One morning, getting dressed for work, I put on one of my baggier suits, and it wasn't baggy. Standing before the mirror, I said to my reflection, uh-oh. But it was more than the stroganoff. Somehow, I'd gotten out of the running habit. Blue ribbon, marriage, fatherhood, there was never time. Also, I'd felt burned out. Though I'd loved running for Bowerman, I'd hated it, too. The same thing happens to all kinds of college athletes. Years of training and competing at a high level take their toll. You need a rest. But now the rest was over. I needed to get back out there. I didn't want to be the fat, flabby, sedentary head of a running shoe company. And if tight suits and the specter of hypocrisy weren't enough incentive, another motivation soon came along. After that all-comers race, after Grella refused me the loan, he and I went for a private run. 4 miles in, I saw Grella looking back at me sadly as I huffed and puffed to keep up. It was one thing to have him refuse me money. It was another to have him give me pity. He knew I was embarrassed, so he challenged me. This fall, he said, let's you and me race 1 mile. I'll give you a full minute handicap, and if you beat me, I'll pay you $1 for every second of difference in our times. I trained hard that summer. I got into the habit of running 6 miles every night after work. In no time, I was back in shape, my weight down to 160. And when the day of the big race came, with Waddell on the stopwatch, I took $36 from Grella. The victory was made all the sweeter the following week when Grella jumped into an all-comers meet and ran 407. As I drove home that day, I felt immensely proud. Keep going, I told myself. Don't stop. At the halfway mark of the year, June 15, 1970, I pulled my Sports Illustrated from my mailbox and got a shock. On the cover was a man of Oregon. And not just any man of Oregon, but perhaps the greatest of all time, greater than even Grella. His name was Steve Prefontaine, and the photo showed him sprinting up the side of Olympus, a.k.a. Bowerman Mountain. The article inside described Pre as an astonishing, once-a-generation phenom. He'd already made a big splash in high school, setting a national record, 8:41, at 2 miles. But now, in his first year at Oregon, running 2 miles, he'd beaten Gary Lindgren, who'd previously been considered unbeatable. And he'd beaten him by 27 seconds. Pre-posted 8:40.0, third fastest time in the nation that year. He'd also run 3 miles in 13:12.8, which in 1970 was faster than anyone anywhere on Earth. Bowerman told the writer from Sports Illustrated that Pre was the fastest middle-distance runner alive. I'd never heard such unbridled enthusiasm from my stolid coach. In the days ahead, in other articles I clipped, Bowerman was even more effusive, calling Pre the best runner I've ever had. Bowerman's assistant, Bill Dellinger, said Pre's secret weapon was his confidence, which was as freakish as his lung capacity. Usually, Dellinger said, it takes our guys 12 years to build confidence in themselves, and here's a young man who has the right attitude naturally. Yes, I thought. Confidence. More than equity or liquidity, that's what a man needs. I wished I had more. I wished I could borrow some. But confidence was cash. You had to have some to get some. And people were loath to give it to you. Another revelation came that summer via another magazine. Flipping through Fortune, I spotted a story about my former boss in Hawaii. In the years since I'd worked for Bernie Kornfeld and his investors overseas services, he'd become even richer. He'd abandoned Dreyfus funds and begun selling shares in his own mutual funds, along with gold mines, real estate, and sundry other things. He'd built an empire, and as all empires eventually do, it was now crumbling. I was so startled by news of his downfall that I dazedly turned the page and happened on another article, a fairly dry analysis of Japan's newfound economic power. 25 years after Hiroshima, the article said, Japan was reborn. the world's third largest economy, it was taking aggressive steps to become even larger, to consolidate its position and extend its reach. But besides simply outthinking and outworking other countries, Japan was adopting ruthless trade policies. The article then sketched the main vehicle for these trade policies, Japan's hyper-aggressive Sogo Socha trading companies. To this day, it's hard to say exactly what those first Japanese trading companies were. Sometimes they were importers, scouring the globe and acquiring raw materials for companies that didn't have the means to do so. Other times they were exporters, representing those same companies overseas. Sometimes they were private banks, providing all kinds of companies with easy terms of credit. Other times they were an arm of the Japanese government. I filed away all this information for a few days. And the next time I went down to First National, the next time Wallace made me feel like a bum, I walked out and saw the sign for Bank of Tokyo. I'd seen that sign 100 times before, of course, but now it meant something different. Huge pieces of the puzzle fell into place. Dizzy, I walked directly across the street, straight into the Bank of Tokyo, and presented myself to the woman at the front desk. I said I owned a shoe company, which was importing shoes from Japan, and I wanted to speak with someone about doing a deal. Like the madam of a brothel, the woman instantly and discreetly led me to a back room and left me. After 2 minutes, a man walked in and sat down very quietly at the table. He waited. I waited. He continued waiting. Finally, I spoke. "I have a company," I said. "Yes," he said. "A shoe company," I said. "Yes," he said. I opened my briefcase. "These are my financial statements. I'm in a terrible bind. I need credit. I just read an article in Fortune about Japanese trading companies, and the article said these companies are looser with credit. And, well, do you know of any such companies that you might introduce me to?" The man smiled. He'd read the same article. He said it just so happened that Japan's sixth largest trading company had an office right above our heads on the top floor of that building. All the major Japanese trading companies had offices in Portland, he said, but this particular one, Nisho Iwai, was the only one in Portland with its own commodities department. "It's $100 billion company," the banker said, eyes widening. "Oh boy," I said. "Please wait," he said. He left the room. Minutes later, he returned with an executive from Nisho Iwai. His name was Cam Murakami. We shook hands and chatted, strictly hypothetically, about the possibility of Nisho financing my future imports. I was intrigued. He was quite intrigued. He offered me a deal on the spot and extended his hand, but I couldn't shake it, not yet. First, I had to clear it with Onitsuka. I sent a wire that day to Kitami, asking if he'd have any objections to my doing side business with Nisho. Days passed. Weeks. With Onitsuka, silence usually meant something. No news was bad news, no news was good news, but no news was always some sort of news. While waiting to hear back, I got a troubling call. A shoe distributor on the East Coast said he'd been approached by Onitsuka about becoming its new U.S. distributor. I made him say it again, slower. He did. He said he wasn't trying to make me angry, nor was he trying to help me out or give me a heads up. He just wanted to know the status of my deal. I began to shake. My heart was pounding. Months after signing a new contract with me, Onitsuka was plotting to break it? Had they been spooked when I was late taking delivery of the spring shipment? Had Kitami simply decided he didn't care for me? My only hope was that this distributor on the East Coast was lying or mistaken. Maybe he'd misunderstood Onitsuka. Maybe it was a language thing. I wrote to Fujimoto. I said I hoped he was still enjoying the bicycle I bought him. Subtle. I asked him to find out anything he could. He wrote back right away. The distributor was telling the truth. Onitsuka was considering a clean break with Blue Ribbon, and Kitami was in touch with several distributors in the United States. There was no firm plan to break my contract, Fujimoto said, but candidates were being vetted and scouted. I tried to focus on the good news. There was no firm plan. This meant there was still hope. I could still restore Onitsuka's faith, change Kitami's mind. But it would require reminding Kitami of what Blue Ribbon was and who I was, which would mean inviting him to the United States for a friendly visit. 1971. Guess who's coming to dinner? Woodell said. He wheeled into my office and handed me the telex. Kitami had accepted my invitation. He was coming to Portland to spend a few days. Then he was going to make a wider tour of the United States for reasons he declined to share. Visiting other potential distributors, I said to Woodell. He nodded. It was March 1971. We vowed that Kitami was going to have the time of his life, that he would return home feeling love in his heart for America, Oregon, Blue Ribbon, and me. When we were done with him, he'd be incapable of doing business with anyone else. And so, we agreed, the visit should close on a high note, with a gala dinner at the home of our prize asset, Bowerman. In mounting this charm offensive, naturally I enlisted Penny. I brought her with me to meet Kitami's flight, and together we whisked him straight to the Oregon coast, to her parents' oceanfront cottage where we'd spent our wedding night. Kitami had a companion with him, a sort of bag carrier, personal assistant, named Hiraku Iwano. He was just a kid, naive, innocent in his early 20s, and Penny had him eating out of her hand before we hit Sunset Highway. We both slaved to give the two men an idyllic Pacific Northwest weekend. We sat on the porch with them and breathed in the sea air. We took them for long walks on the beach. We fed them world-class salmon and poured them glass after glass of good French wine. We tried to focus most of our attention on Kitami, but both Penny and I found it easier to talk to Iwano, who read books and seemed guileless. Kitami seemed like a man who was importing guile by the boatload. Monday, bright and early, I drove Kitami back to Portland, to First National Bank. Just as I was determined to charm him on this trip, I thought that he could be helpful in charming Wallace, and that he could vouch for Blue Ribbon and make credit easier to get. White met us in the lobby and walked us into a conference room. I looked around. "Where's Wallace?" I asked. "Ah," White said, "he won't be able to join us today." "What?" That was the whole point of visiting the bank. I wanted Wallace to hear Kitami's ringing endorsement. "Oh, well," I thought, "good cop will just have to relay the endorsement to bad cop." I said a few preliminary words, expressed confidence that Kitami could bolster First National's faith in Blue Ribbon, then turned the floor over to Kitami, who scowled and did the one thing guaranteed to make my life harder. "Why do you not give my friends more money?" he said to White. "What?" White said. "Why do you refuse to extend credit to Blue Ribbon?" Kitami said, pounding his fist on the table. "Well now," White said. Kitami cut him off. "What kind of bank is this? I do not understand. Maybe Blue Ribbon would be better off without you." White turned white. I tried to jump in. I tried to rephrase what Kitami was saying, tried to pretend that something had been lost in the translation, but the meeting was over. White stormed out, and I stared in astonishment at Kitami, who was wearing an expression that said, "Job well done." I drove Kitami to our new offices in Tigard and showed him around, introduced him to the gang. I was fighting hard to maintain my composure, to remain pleasant, to block out all thoughts about what had just happened. I was afraid that at any second I might lose it. But when I settled Kitami into a chair across from my desk, it was he who lost it. At me. "Blue Ribbon sales are disappointing," he said. "You should be doing much better." Stunned, I said that our sales were doubling every year. "Not good enough," he snapped. Should be triple, some people say, he said. What people, I asked. Never mind, he said. He took a folder from his briefcase, flipped it open, read it, snapped it shut. He repeated that he didn't like our numbers, that he didn't think we were doing enough. He opened the folder again, shut it again, shoved it back into his briefcase. I tried to defend myself, but he waved his hand in disgust. Back and forth we went for quite a while, civil but tense. After nearly an hour of this, he stood and asked to use the men's room. Down the hall, I said. The moment he was out of sight, I jumped from behind my desk. I opened his briefcase and rummaged through and took out what looked like the folder he'd been referring to. I slid it under my desk blotter, then jumped behind my desk and put my elbows on the blotter. Waiting for Kitami to return, I had the strangest thought. I recalled all the times I'd volunteered with the Boy Scouts, all the times I'd sat on Eagle Scout review boards handing out merit badges for honor and integrity. Two or three weekends a year, I'd question pink-cheeked boys about their probity, their honesty. And now I was stealing documents from another man's briefcase. I was headed down a brambly, rocky path, no telling where it might lead. Wherever, there was no getting around one immediate consequence of my actions. I'd have to recuse myself from the next review board. How I longed to study the contents of that folder and photocopy every scrap of paper in it and go over it all with Waddell. But Kitami was soon back. I let him resume scolding me about sluggish numbers, let him talk himself out, and when he stopped, I summed up my position. Calmly, I said that Blue Ribbon might increase its sales if we could order more shoes, and we might order more shoes if we had more financing, and our bank might give us more financing if we had more security, meaning a longer contract with Onitsuka. Again, he waved his hand. Excuses, he said. I raised the idea of funding our orders through a Japanese trading company, like Nisho Iwai, as I'd mentioned in my wire months before. Bah, he said, trading companies. They send money first, men later. Take over. Work way into your company, then take over. Translation, Onitsuka was only manufacturing a quarter of its own shoes, subcontracting the other three quarters. Kitami was afraid that Nisho would find Onitsuka's network of factories, then go right around Onitsuka and become a manufacturer and put Onitsuka out of business. Kitami stood. He needed to go back to his hotel, he said, and have a rest. I said I'd have someone drive him, and I'd meet him for a cocktail later at his hotel bar. The instant he was gone, I went and found Waddell and told him what had happened, what I'd done. I held up the folder. I stole this from his briefcase, I said. You did what? Waddell said. He started to act appalled, but he was just as curious as I was about the folder's contents. Together we opened it and laid it on his desk and found that it contained, among other things, a list of 18 athletic shoe distributors across the United States and a schedule of appointments with half of them. So there it was. In black and white, some people say. The some people damning Blue Ribbon, poisoning Kitami against us, were our competitors. And he was on his way to visit them. Kill one Marlboro man, 20 more rise up to take his place. I was outraged, of course, but mostly hurt. For 7 years, we devoted ourselves to Tiger shoes. We'd introduced them to America. We'd reinvented the line. Bowerman and Johnson had shown Onitsuka how to make a better shoe, and their designs were now foundational, setting sales records, changing the face of the industry, and this was how we were repaid? And now, I said to Waddell, I have to go meet this Judas for cocktails. First, I went on a 6-mile run. I don't know when I've run harder or been less present in my body. With each stride, I yelled at the trees, screamed at the cobwebs hanging in the branches. It helped. By the time I'd showered and dressed and driven to meet Kitami at his hotel, I was almost serene. Or maybe I was in shock, because what Kitami said during that hour together, what I said, I have no memory. The next thing I remember is this. The following morning, when Kitami came to the office, Woodell and I ran a sort of shell game. While someone whisked Kitami